Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in a surprising outcome on Tuesday, Kansas voters upheld abortion rights in their state's constitution. We'll talk about what the vote could indicate for states like Wisconsin and how it might impact the 2022 midterm elections. First, the role of college has changed a lot over the decades. The GI Bill opened the door to higher education for many World War II veterans, and some states moved toward tuition-free higher education. Those trends changed over the years, with less state support for colleges and higher tuitions. That put college out of reach for a lot of Americans and left many others wondering whether the cost and the debt were worth it. And our next guest says changes in higher education have created one of the major dividing lines in American politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important was the idea of going to college to you when you were growing up or maybe raising kids? Did it seem like college was just off the table no matter what? Do you think access to college is an important part of your political views, your world views? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Will Bunch is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His latest book is called After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Will, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah. Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Before we dig into some of the history here, I want to start with some pretty recent history, a big divide, a widening divide in who people vote for based on their college career, how much education they've gotten. Can you talk about that and how it sets you on this path of researching this?
Absolutely. And you're right, Rob. It did start me on the path because as a journalist who, you know, mainly covered politics, I was trying to figure out some things I was seeing. You know, why were voters in places like the Paper Valley in Wisconsin who were seeing their jobs, you know, outsourced to China or Mexico? You know, why weren't they mad at the CEOs who were doing the outsourcing? Because I would listen to these shows like Rush Limbaugh, and the anger I was hearing wasn't directed at business, you know, or these capitalist decisions that were being made. It was being directed at people in the media. It was being directed at college professors and Hollywood movie stars. And I wanted to try and explain that. And while I was doing this research, you know, every election cycle, college attainment, whether or not you have a college degree, clearly was becoming the fault line in American politics, to the point where in each election, more and more, the Democrats are the party of the college-educated people with diplomas, and Republicans increasingly are the party of the working class people who didn't go to college, and frankly, people who have a lot of resentment towards people they see as elites looking down on them. So, you know, absolutely. You know, political scientists more and more are finding that it's not economics, it's not class. It's even though those things are related, but when you really drill down, it's educational attainment is the biggest determinant these days of who you're going to vote for.
I want to touch on some of the history here to look at a couple different visions of what higher education could be and how that's changed. I want to start in the aftermath of World War II and the GI Bill, which sent a lot of mostly male, mostly white veterans from a lot of different social classes to college, maybe people who never would have thought of college. Can you talk about that vision of education and a road that could have led to?
Yeah, you know, the history of college in the last 75 years is fascinating, and it's really been this constant debate over two questions, which is who is college for and who should pay for it? And in the story really starts in the 1940s, because before then, only about 5% of the American public obtained college degrees. In fact, the majority of people didn't graduate high school and going into World War II. But you had this kind of fluke almost where Congress was looking for ways to reward returning veterans and also to keep them occupied, basically. And they offered this college benefit, and people took it in numbers that just weren't anticipated. You know, a couple million people within 2 or 3 years of the program enrolled in college, to the point where some colleges had to build Quonset huts to house the overflow of people. You know, enrollment doubled at a lot of schools, and what it really established was the middle class could really benefit from higher education, and maybe we should make higher education a public good the way that K through 12 education has always been in this country. And, you know, so you had this era, not, you know, in addition to the GI Bill, just low tuition generally at public universities, which were expanding rapidly in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And that era eventually came crashing down, partly because of politics. There was a conservative element in this country that really didn't like what was happening at some of these college campuses because people were taking their liberal education and protesting the Vietnam War, or they were protesting racial segregation. And this backlash was kind of led by Ronald Reagan, who said that college shouldn't be for people's intellectual curiosity, it should be for getting a job. And one of the aspects of that backlash was tuition started to rise. You know, state governments started to support higher education less and less over the years with taxpayer dollars.
So that leads to, as you mentioned, higher tuitions, less access for some people to college. And you you use Wisconsin as a big example in the Scott Walker years, fast forwarding a little more, to a sort of politics of resentment against college. What do you see happening here?
Well, a couple things. One, Scott Walker is just a fascinating case study, you know, because he's a guy who, you know, had a picture of Ronald Reagan over his desk in his college dorm room, right, when he attended Marquette. He's really the political offspring of Ronald Reagan. And understand, you know, Reagan wasn't against the dream of people going to college, which, you know, really did become the American dream after World War II. You know, I mean, Reagan thought that people should pay for it, that people should study, they shouldn't be protesting. The generation of Republican leaders that's kind of epitomized by Scott Walker took things to a next level. You know, they began to see college is the enemy, you know, that liberal professors were protesting their conservative politics. They didn't like what students were being taught. And so, you know, under somebody like a Scott Walker, you saw more extreme cuts in state support for the public university system. You saw an assault on tenure, you know, particularly targeting again, professors who were deemed liberal and seen as critics. And I think Scott Walker's attitude was summed up in this amazing incident that happened in 2015, where it came out that his administration was working to actually change the mission statement of the University of Wisconsin. Wisconsin had this bold mission statement that, you know, the university's main core value is the pursuit of the truth. And Scott Walker wanted to take that language out, and he wanted to replace it with language that was very boilerplate about how the university is for workforce development, period. And he ended up not doing that. I mean, there was a backlash, you know, many people still believe in the idea that college education is something that's supposed to make you a better person, a critical thinker. But I think that whole episode defines this notion that a lot of conservatives don't like the idea of higher education as a way to develop critical thinking, or as a way to use kind of a general education to study the humanities or social sciences and develop a kind of more tolerant and more diverse worldview. A lot of conservatives feel threatened by that, frankly.
We're talking to Will Bunch. His new book is After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does college fit into your American dream? Were you able to go to college if you wanted to, or was it financially impossible for you to do that even if you wanted to? Do you think that more people should go to college? Do we need other alternatives for post-high school? What should that look like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Will Bunch. His new book is After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions to what our guest has to say at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Will, let's talk about the modern day now. It seems like the system, as you describe it, is broken for two groups of people, those who can't get into college, maybe for financial reasons, they don't have access to it, and people who can get into college and are worried, is it worth it? Is it worth the debt that's piling up? What, describe the brokenness as you see it of our current system.
Yeah, well, our young people are told that they can't get ahead in this country and in our current economy without a college degree. And certainly a college degree, it can add $1 million to your income over the course of a lifetime. So obviously it's a worthwhile pursuit. The problem is the front end, getting a college degree has become so expensive, and programs like Pell Grants and financial aid just don't come close to making up the gap between what college costs and what families are expected to pay. And so millions of families have gone into debt to finance college, or they're intimidated away from the college track. There was a fascinating survey after the 2016 election that found one of the biggest determinants of voting for Donald Trump was people who felt that college was a risky gamble for their family, that they had a sense of economic fatalism, that they weren't going to succeed in society without a college education, but yet college education just wasn't going to happen for them. And you mentioned in an earlier question about the resentment. I think that's where a lot of the resentment comes in. So you have a situation that makes people on almost most people on all sides kind of angry, right? The people who have this debt, who can't buy a house in their late 20s, don't even feel they can get married because they have this debt hanging over their head. But they're mad about that. The people who've been locked out of this system that's called a meritocracy, but yet they're told because they didn't succeed in it, they must somehow lack merit, that they must have less worth because they don't have a college degree, which isn't true. But, people feel that they get that vibe from the educated and they're angry about it. So, it really explains a lot of our divide right now.
Go to our callers at 800-642-1234. By the way, if you were just trying to call in, we had a little phone glitch. Try again, 800-642-1234. Rick is with us now in Monona. Rick, hi.
Hi. I heard you mention the GI Bill when I first tuned in. And I must say that one of the great government programs ever invented. I was a poor kid. I served in the Navy, and when I got out, it provided me a chance to go to college, and that experience has changed my life. It's been such a wonderful thing to have, and I couldn't have done it without the monthly stipend that the GI Bill provided. It was life-saving and kept me going, so... first of all, that's my endorsement of that. The second thing I wanted to mention, or ask your guest, and that is, how did college become so expensive? When I went to school, and this would have been in 1970 to about 75, it was like $50 a credit. Now it's, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, and that's for state institutions. What happened to that money that the government used to supplement it?
Gotcha, Rick. Thanks a lot for sharing your experience with the military benefits for campus there. And to his question, Will, whole book's been written about this. How did college get so darn expensive?
It's a long story. It's happened. It's really been building up since the late 1970s is when tuition started to rise every year. Higher than inflation and even higher than things like the cost of healthcare. That's how much the cost of college tuition has risen over those years. a couple things happened. Harvard kind of set the pace on this. They were worried about the
shrinking enrollments after the baby boom and during the down economy of the 1970s. They decided, you know, because they were Harvard, that there were certain people from the upper classes that would pay anything for their kids to attend, and maybe they could use some of the extra money to channel aid back to some middle class families. So they call this the high tuition, high aid model. So they kept when they raised tuition the first year and they still got the same number of applicants, they went ahead and kept raising tuition every year, and they still kept getting applicants. And the problem is most schools don't have huge endowments like Harvard does, and they just can't provide the levels of financial aid for middle class students that some of these Ivy League schools do. And that's when the gap between what college cost and what people could afford and what they were getting in things like Pell Grants really started to take off. And, you know, colleges generally found that they've been able to market themselves to parents and their kids on prestige more than price. You know, colleges have spent a lot of money on these perks like lazy rivers and rock walls and having gourmet food courts in some cases, because they're competing for students, and they find that they do better competing on prestige. And even if they have to recruit wealthy out-of-state kids or wealthy kids from China or India to fill up the student body, this has become the model, and the people who are suffering are the American middle-class kids who can't afford this system.
Thanks for that call, Rick. We're talking to Will Bunch about his new book, After the Ivory Tower Falls. We'll go now to Patrick in Wausau. Patrick, hi.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm curious to get Will's perspective on this. You know, in the hospitality industry, it seems like communities try to get heads in beds. And in the education community, it just seems like the different education institutions are competing to get butts in seats. What I don't understand is, why is it that we can't provide high school juniors and seniors with some kind of counseling to let those kids know, to let the kids who, you know, who counselors or some assessment would really feel that the kids would thrive in a technical college setting, to encourage them to go there. And kids who would thrive going to a 2 or 4 year community campus, you know, suggest they go there.
Patrick, thanks for the call. I'll expand that even a bit. Will, you say the answer here isn't just about the people who do end up going to college. It's the people who might go to a technical college, as Patrick talks about. But also, we should be thinking about people on career paths that don't involve college. What would you want to see in those last years of high school, or maybe that year after high school?
Yeah, you know, I think Patrick really, really hit the nail on the head with his question about, I mean, I argue in the book that people are making bad decisions, and people in their families really are making bad decisions at age 18. You know, they're feeling a lot of pressure either to get into the right school or to make a decision about going to college or whether or not going to college, and being told that what they decide when they're 18 is going to determine the rest of their life. Quickly, I'll say, I mean, the book argues, you know, that we shouldn't just reduce the cost of public universities, that we should be able to offer, you know, free or low cost trade schools and other options for people who aren't inclined to sit in a traditional, you know, university classroom for 4 years. But the other thing I really get behind is, and it kind of ties into what he said about the guidance counseling, I think we should have a universal gap year for 18-year-olds, where instead of racing off to college or starting their career, that we have a massive, you know, civilian service, you know, civilian national service, where people, you know, get signed up for projects like conservation. You know, I mean, President Biden has proposed something along these lines, the Civilian Climate Corps, for example. But I would expand it to more areas, you know, working in schools and working in underserved communities, you know, and give people a year to, first of all, you know, work with kids from other communities. You know, we're so siloed right now into the red states and the blue states and, you know, cities versus rural, and bring people from different backgrounds together and try and find ways that Americans can have common purpose, because everybody agrees that's one of the biggest problems in the country right now is division. I'm not saying an 18-year-old gap year would totally solve the problem, but it's an idea that would help get us thinking about the problem quite a bit and make a lot of progress. So yeah, there's a lot we can do to change the system.
In our last just over a minute or so, Will, do you see people taking this problem seriously, tackling it head on, trying to make significant changes that'll help bridge these gaps, both in access to education and mutual resentment for the people who go to college and those who don't?
Well, the good news is we're starting to have some conversations around this, right? I mean, President Biden right now is supposedly making a big decision on what to do about the $1.75 trillion in college debt that's really hanging over a couple generations of young people. And I think dealing with that debt crisis is a start, but there needs to be a grand bargain. Like I said, you know, if you just tackle debt and don't do anything else, then the freshmen entering college this month are going to start accumulating new debt. You know, we need to come up with a bigger idea of, you know, using our resources as the richest country on earth to figure out a way to make higher education a public good, the way that K-12 education is accepted as a public good in this country.
We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me. It was great. I appreciate it.
That's Will Bunch, national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He was with us today to talk about his new book. It's called After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this, your experiences maybe. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, a political scientist joins the show to break down Tuesday's vote in Kansas, upholding abortion rights in that state's constitution, and to talk about a gap between public opinion on abortion and measures that have cropped up across the country. Also, we've got an ongoing conversation that we'll come back to later in the show. We want to know your favorite video game or computer game of all time, if any, or phone game, you name it, or if the whole concept leaves you cold. Either way, you can let us know right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email centraltime@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, from arcade consoles to virtual reality, there are decades of great video games to explore. We'll ask you to call in with your favorites and what makes them special. Now, voters in Kansas voted overwhelmingly Tuesday to recognize abortion rights in the state's constitution. The outcome was a surprise to a lot of political observers because polling had shown a slight lead for anti-abortion activists, and because Kansas is a conservative state that voted in 2020 for former President Donald Trump by a margin of 14 points. We're talking about the message those results may send about where voters are at on abortion rights, how the results could impact the 2022 midterms, and what they mean for states with a less conservative electorate, like Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is abortion a voting issue for you? If you had a chance to, in some kind of referendum like they had in Kansas, we don't really have that here in Wisconsin, to vote for or against abortion rights in Wisconsin, how would you vote? You can play political pundit if you like. Do you think that the abortion issue, since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, is going to sway voters one way or another in Wisconsin and around the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Alisa Von Hagel is a professor of political science at UW-Superior. She studies the role of experts in reproductive health legislation in Wisconsin. That's as part of UW-Madison's Collaborative for Reproductive Equity. Alisa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me this afternoon.
All right. It's maybe easy to overread what happened in Kansas and maybe to underread. How significant is this vote outcome in Kansas, do you think?
I mean, it is quite significant. It was the first vote on a ballot after the Dobbs ruling that has occurred. So a lot of people nationwide were looking at the case. But as you mentioned, it was truly very surprising, the outcome. And it really sent a very strong signal that voters would organize, especially women would register to vote, would organize, would turn out to the polls, would wait in line for hours to vote on this issue specifically. And so it does send a very clear signal to candidates as well as you know, for elections in the future. So it, I think it is a quite significant action in and of itself.
I've seen some people say, okay, yes, if you're voting straight up on an issue, that's one thing. When you're voting for a candidate, there are a whole bundle of issues, abortion just being one of them. How can we figure out, can we figure out whether the way people might have voted on this might translate into supporting a candidate who's for or against abortion?
Well, that's the key. That's the key question, right? And so there is some limited polling that has come out that shows that there is a slight increase in preferences for a Democratic candidate who is supportive of abortion rights in the upcoming elections versus a Republican candidate who is not in support. And so there does seem to be little evidence. It's not as strong as we would find for just a simple up or down vote on abortion access, like the ballot measure was in Kansas. So there does seem to be some indication of some influence, but again, the extent to which it, you know, plays out, it'll vary state by state and certainly won't be to the extent that we saw in Kansas.
Now, public opinion polling on abortion can be tricky. I mean, there's some percentage of the American public that wants absolutely no abortion and wants it to be completely illegal. Some on the opposite end that wants basically no or little or no restriction on abortion. But a lot of people come out in the middle, and sometimes when you ask them in different ways about roughly the same thing, they might not agree with themselves. It's a more complicated issue than pro and con.
Absolutely. And I think that was one of the problems with this abortion ban specifically, is that, you know, by and large, you know, people understand the nuance, the complexity of the issue, and an outright ban on a procedure, on a medical, you know, health procedure, is not preferred by the vast majority of Americans, similar in Kansas as it is in Wisconsin and other places around the country. But people are more willing to accept, you know, limitations or restrictions on the procedures, different types of procedures or the timing of procedures. So it's these complete outright bans that, by and large, there doesn't really seem to be support amongst the electorate nationwide and within a state to justify such actions.
Alisa von Hagel is with us, professor of political science at UW-Superior. We're looking at this vote in Kansas on a measure that would have changed the Constitution, allow a potentially complete ban on abortion if lawmakers went that way. It was rejected by a pretty decent margin in a pretty conservative state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think abortion will play a big role in 2022 elections here in Wisconsin and around the country? Do you think it should play a big role? Will it influence your vote? Are you conflicted on the issue of abortion? Are you not sure where you think laws and regulations should stand? You're not alone. If so, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Focusing on Wisconsin, Alisa, Wisconsin's Republican candidates for governor describe themselves as pro-life. Here's a listen to some of what they said about abortion. This is at a July debate hosted by TMJ4 News. We'll hear in order Timothy Rampton, then Rebecca Clayfish, then Tim Michaels.
I do not support abortion in any form. I support what Pro-Life Wisconsin has to the T, 100%.
So let me be very clear here. Miscarriage care and ectopic pregnancy treatment are not abortion.
Let's give them all the options, all the solutions that are out there. Let's talk to them about adoption. Let's talk to them about monies that are available for infants and toddlers out there.
Do you have thoughts, Alisa, on how abortion may play into the Wisconsin race for governor?
I think that's an interesting question. So abortion there's always been a very strong, people have always held strong beliefs, you know, pro or con or what have you, but it hasn't been a highly salient political issue that affects elections like other issues do, such as the economy or immigration. However, with the Dobbs ruling, mm-hmm. And this increased activism, it seems that there may be, you know, it may increase in salience or importance to people. And it may, you know, we may start to see a bit more of an effect of the abortion issue on elections and people paying more attention to the positions of candidates on the specific issue.
Right. Roe, I think, has been seen as a political guardrail where people could say, okay, even if a state legislature, say, passes a particular abortion law, if it goes too far, the U.S. Supreme Court is just going to bop it down. So abortion might have been less relevant to voters. That guardrail's gone now in some ways, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. That's very well stated. And I think that by and large, with the ruling in Roe, since Roe, the issue has been one that has been sort of in the Republican wheelhouse. They have benefited election-wise, just organizing because of the, you know, just they are responding to the, you know, the ruling in Roe. But in this post-Dobbs era, it seems that this will be an issue that will be more, you know, Democrats will be able to organize around, will be able to really utilize in upcoming elections much more successfully. And so it's kind of in their wheelhouse now to utilize as such to not just, you know, vote down ballots or vote, you know, in support of certain amendments or ballots, but to also help candidates in upcoming elections.
We're talking to Alisa von Hagel, political science professor at UW Superior, faculty affiliate with UW-Madison's Collaborative for Reproductive Equity, looking at the vote in Kansas on Tuesday to uphold abortion rights in that state, what it could indicate for states around the country in a big election year. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a gap between how you feel about abortion and the laws on abortion where you live, whether that's Wisconsin or beyond? What do you want to hear from candidates in this year's midterm elections, in particular running for governor, U.S. Senate, state legislature, Congress? Is this something that you think will motivate you to vote, to help get other people out to vote? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about Kansas's vote to preserve abortion rights in that state's constitution, people watching it as an indicator for what might happen in elections around the country this year. Alisa von Hagel is with us from UW Superior, and you could join in too at 800-642-1234. Were you watching this vote in Kansas? What was your reaction? Pro or con? What do you want to see ultimately happen with abortion laws here in Wisconsin in this post Roe v. Wade era? Is this something that will affect your vote come election day? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Alisa, there's been some polling out there showing kind of what populations of various states think about abortion as it compares to the laws that states have on abortion, and they don't always match up very well. What kind of things do we see?
I mean, absolutely. We see restrictive abortion bans or altogether outright bans in places where over a majority of the state's population is not in support of an outright ban or certain restrictions. And so there is very much so this gap between whether it's the, you know, lawmakers' preferences or the beliefs of what their constituents want or some combination thereof. And so there is a very much so a disconnect in many, many states around the country with respect to abortion laws and what the population within those states would prefer.
Looking again at this election season, do you see Democrats likely to look at this vote in Kansas and say, hey, we better try to make this election more about abortion than they might have, you know, before they thought on Tuesday?
Absolutely. I think after the Dobbs ruling came out, it was clear that this was an issue that would bring energy and intensity to any organizing efforts, particularly for the Democratic Party. And with this vote in Kansas and the, you know, surprising outcome that occurred, I think absolutely sort of cemented the idea that, you know, perhaps not in absolutely every single district and every single state, but by and large, Democrats can definitely utilize this issue as a way to generate new voter registrants, to get higher voter turnout, to get people to the polls. Midterms, we don't really see as many voters to the polls as we see in presidential election cycles. And so it very may well be an issue that will get people to the polls out to vote where we haven't seen in years past.
Flipping that around to Republicans now, are they asking themselves, should we think about our messaging on abortion, or should we be messaging on things other than abortion between now and November?
Yeah. So for those, you know, who candidates who have very ideological, strong beliefs and have been very clear about their positions on abortion and their opposition, it's hard to see how they would, you know, pedal back or soften that perspective. I know in Florida, the governor there would prefer an abortion ban, but instead of, you know, placing it before the voters or even lawmakers, that it's leaving it up to the courts and having it, you know, decided upon the courts, and that so there's not the blowback that, say, politicians or himself would receive by amongst unhappy constituents. So we may find that sort of just passing the buck on the issue, so to speak, and leaving the issue up to the courts more so than leaving it up to voters or to lawmakers. But again, every state will certainly be different.
And now Kansas had this vote on a constitutional amendment. We don't really have binding referenda here in Wisconsin, asterisk, unless a state legislature passes a constitutional amendment in two consecutive sessions, and then it could go to voters. That happens pretty rarely. We don't really generally have this kind of voters you decide process here in the state, do we?
Correct. And it's a very uphill battle to get an amendment to the Wisconsin Constitution. Absolutely.
Looking now at the governor's race in Wisconsin, again, we heard from Republican voters earlier. Now we've got Governor Evers talking about the issue, and he's described himself as kind of a goalie trying to stop Republican state lawmakers from making changes. How important do you think this issue will be for him between now and November?
Absolutely. I think it's very much part of his agenda, and he's been very clear from day one of his administration that he is in support of access to abortion. And he has been vetoing what he sees as too restrictive of laws that have been passed through the state legislature. And I think it will become, or it will remain very central to his campaign, and will be very useful, I believe, in terms of emphasizing this particular issue as it's seemingly more and more important amongst voters. So for Evers, it definitely is an issue that he would want to highlight and continue to highlight what he has done as governor in his previous term.
We're talking to Elisa Von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior, looking at this Kansas vote on abortion rights, an attempt to change the Constitution that would allow lawmakers potentially to ban abortion in that state, figuring out what it could mean for the 2022 midterm elections. Patrick joins us now in Viroqua. Patrick, hi.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for the show. And I was just thinking about the phrase poetic justice. After all, we all know how hard the Republicans worked to get the last three justices on that Supreme Court. And I just talked to the Republicans at the fair booths, and even they say that this is going to make it a lot harder in the midterms. So be careful what you work for, huh?
Patrick, thanks for the call. Lisa, what do you think?
I mean, absolutely. I've heard similar statements by certain officials in the Republican Party that absolutely they do recognize that it's now creating a much more difficult or uphill battle with respect to this issue in general, but also, you know, elections writ large, and especially if abortion becomes a defining central issue in a state election, it very much so could be a, you know, the issue that leads to either decreased turnout for, say, Republican candidates or voters that switch or vote Democrat who usually support or vote for Republicans.
Thanks for that call. And just our last few moments, Elisa, this was Kansas, kind of a one-off here. What are you watching for next on public opinion, abortion, and the way people vote?
Well, so there are a handful of states that have ballots such as this on the upcoming election in November. Two states, California and Vermont, have constitutional amendments that would insert a specific right to access abortion into the Constitution, which would be interesting if that would to go into effect if there's support for that. There are two other states, Kansas and Montana, that are attempting to also have a constitutional amendment similar to that as of Kansas. And so, again, we'll see then, I suppose, if Kansas was a one-off one, blip in that didn't really resonate nationwide. But so it'll be interesting to follow those particular races and during the election and to see how those play out.
Thanks to our guest, Alisa von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior, with us today to talk about the role abortion rights could play in this year's midterms after Kansas voted by a big margin on Tuesday to uphold abortion protections in the state's constitution. For more than a year, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes emphasized his middle-class roots and progressive record while running a Democratic primary campaign for U.S. Senate. Now that his top Democratic opponents have dropped out, his challenge will be to win over independent voters in a general election campaign against Republican incumbent Senator Ron Johnson. Rich Kramer has this report.
At the July Farm Technology Days Exposition in Clark County, a handful of Democratic candidates worked the crowd, hoping to make inroads with rural Wisconsinites who typically lean Republican. At the State Democratic Party Rural Caucus tent, Mandela Barnes went one-on-one with dairy farmer Hans Breitenmoser of Merrill.
Well, can we talk policy for
a minute?
We can talk.
Let's go. Let's have at it.
They talked fuel prices, health care, trade policy, and campaign finance reform. Barnes told Breitenmoser change is slow in the Senate, in part because it's a millionaire's club. Barnes said he's a different kind of candidate.
And if we don't have people in office who understand our struggles, things will never change.
That was less than a month ago. A lot has changed since then. All of Barnes' top Democratic competitors dropped out of the race in late July and endorsed his campaign.
It really is unprecedented.
That's Jessica Taylor. She covers Senate and governor's races for the National Cook Political Report.
And I think it speaks to the fact that this is Democrats' number one incumbent in Ron Johnson that they are targeting.
In his own words, Barnes' journey from Milwaukee kid to running to be Wisconsin's first black U.S. senator is a very Wisconsin story.
I come from a working class household. My mother was a public school teacher for 30 years. My dad worked on an assembly line, third shift for 30 years.
Barnes has consistently leaned on his upbringing to add personal flair to liberal policies championed by progressive Democrats. He recalls his dad making catalytic converters in Oak Creek following the Clean Air Act of 1970 when talking about transitioning to renewable energy. After the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, Barnes talked about his mother's abortion during a debate.
She had a complicated pregnancy. Her health was at risk. She had to make the decision to end that pregnancy. But it was her decision to make. And that's a decision that any woman across this country should be able to make without interference from politicians.
Barnes, who is Wisconsin's first ever black lieutenant governor, says he started thinking about getting involved in politics in 2004. He says he was inspired while watching a Democratic National Convention speech by then Illinois U.S. Senator Barack Obama.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely.
And so I thought about the things that I lived through in my life. They weren't the worst in the world, but they were still some things and some trying times that a lot of people shouldn't have to experience.
Barnes has shown an ambitious streak in politics. He won his first campaign for the legislature in 2012. 6 years later, he won a Democratic primary for lieutenant governor to join Tony Evers' successful ticket in the race for governor. Democratic State Representative Francesca Hong says she's worked closely with Barnes in the lieutenant governor's office on issues like climate change.
When you feel like you have an ally and sharing your platform and connecting with folks who don't always have an entryway to politics, him being really open to that helped me as a freshman legislator feel like, okay, I can keep pushing.
Barnes' progressive platform and major endorsements from liberal favorites like U.S. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have served him well in the Democratic primary. But the Cook Report's Taylor says Barnes will need to build support in rural areas between now and the general election.
And so that's where I could think that he could do some work and maybe a populist message could appeal there. But Barnes has been the one that Republicans most wanted to run against.
The attacks have already begun, with Republicans painting Barnes as a radical liberal who is out of touch with average Wisconsinites. Barnes says he's ready for the onslaught and believes his middle-class message and grassroots enthusiasm will win the day November 8th. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on a special edition of The Morning Show, this week marks the 10th anniversary of the mass shooting at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek. Find out how the community has worked to remember and recover and to help prevent future tragedies. And join in with your thoughts, your memories of that day along the way. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes days just feel like they go by really fast, right? Usually, now that's just a personal feeling. But if you felt like that on a day in late June, well, you were right, and you have a very good sense of time. As reported by Smithsonian Magazine, scientists have confirmed that on June 29th, the planet Earth had its fastest recorded rotation, falling short of the full 24 hours by 1.59 milliseconds. So no, we wouldn't really notice that. And it's not as weird as it might sound. The planet has a sloshy core, which can affect rotation speed, so it doesn't really hit that perfect 24-hour mark every day. The long-term trend is a very gradual slowdown, so we even need to add leap seconds to some years to keep our daily Earth clock in line with our yearly orbit around the sun clock. But in the last couple years, we've seen faster rotations like the one on June 29th. If that keeps up, we might need to take back one of those leap seconds. Or we can just schedule really boring work meetings. It always makes a day longer. Plus or minus 1.59 milliseconds, this is Central Time.